Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Seed of wisdom. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. My apologies, I was at Ann Arbor. We spoke to about 75 men, had mass for them, and then Mr. Monahan took me to a high school in Ann Arbor. So they assembled the 240 children. I talked to them, to the youngsters there, and then I told my driver, supposed to get, so be 72, 73, 74 miles an hour we were going. And we made it. Now first, to finish up, what we're going to do today, by the way, after we finish St. Augustine, is start the Little Flower. And I hope she appreciates having tests. Oh no. Who but a Jesuit would dare to do that? So you will have these distributed, but first let's finish up St. Augustine. Unless I'm mistaken, we had 'm I correct, the last set of questions. They are from 80. Did I give you all of that? Did I give you from 80 to 200?
100.
Please?
100.
Oh, what? Only from 80 to 100.
Yeah.
So, why do you stand upon yourself and so not stand at all? This means that. A, B, or C? Sister?
C, Father.
C. The virtue of continence is impossible without the grace of God. Yeah, what was Augustine talking about? Was he talking about charity or chastity?
Chastity.
He was talking about?
Chastity.
Okay. So, it is it's either A or C. But C is better than A. Number 82. How lovely I suddenly found it to be free from the loneliness of those vanities. This means that. Some help.
B.
Augustine's conversion was accompanied by a sudden distaste for the sinful attraction of lust. Okay. What do you think? Do you think B is correct? Please? Anybody else have another? C? So, how lovely I suddenly found it to be free from the loneliness of those vanities. God's grace can deliver us from the seductiveness of sin. Is that true?
Yes.
Augustine's conversion was accompanied by a sudden distaste for the sinful attraction of lust. Is that true?
Yes.
So, I think the sudden and suddenly, I think B is, all three are okay, but the number B, I think is the better answer. Number 83. My memory reminds me how pleasant it is, O Lord, to confess to you what inner goads you use to tame me. God inspired Augustine with a deep interior fears. God urged Augustine to give up his sinful life. God's grace prodded Augustine to sacrifice the creatures that led him into sin. Best answer? Daniel?
C, I think.
C. Thanks for your humility, I think. Yeah, I think it's C. 84. Come, Lord, work upon us. Call us back. Set us on fire and clasp us close. Be fragrant to us. Draw us to thy loveliness. God must draw us to himself before we are drawn to God. God's grace can make his service of him very attractive to us. We must pray, making or asking God to make himself attractive to our souls. What's the best answer?
C.
Lee?
C.
C? What do you think?
I have A, Father.
You have A. Kathleen?
I have C, Father.
I think C is the best. All three are correct. You see? These are the hardest kind of questions because, you know, they're so close and much depends on, you know, what the instructor had in mind when he put them together. I think, notice, come Lord, work upon us. You see, he's praying, he's asking. Number 85, I was unhappy at the life I led of the world. This means that when God draws a sinner to conversion, he makes the sinner unhappy with his sinful life. B. God makes virtue attractive to the sinner so that he may abandon his sinful life. C. Unhappiness in the life of a sinner is a sign of God's grace. Please?
C.
C again? You think C? Any other? Daniel, what do you think? What do you agree with?
A or C.
Either A or C. Talk about 85. Well, I think C is better than A because it has the word grace in there. In other words, there are two kinds of unhappiness in this world. The unhappiness of sinners, which is a great grace, so they will give up the life of sin. There is the unhappiness of people who are trying to serve God. What is that? If a sinner is unhappy, that's a sign of grace. If a person who wants to serve God is unhappy, what is that a sign of?
That's how the devil works. Discouraged.
Temptation. Yeah. So happiness in a sinner is an inspiration of God. Did I see happiness? Unhappiness. Unhappiness in a sinner is an inspiration of grace. Unhappiness in a person who's trying to serve God is an instigation of the devil. And well, you sisters in your constitutions are told to be cheerful. Now, sometimes, as you know, it's pretty hard even to feel happy, much less show it. Because what is the only source of true happiness?
The state of grace? God?
Yes, but
God.
More. Okay, I mean, I can't question. Somebody.
What was Mary. Your question, Father?
In God's will.
My question. What was my question?
True happiness. To be in God's will, Father?
What is What is the only true source of happiness in this world?
Jesus. To be in God's will, Father?
Please?
To be in God's will?
I don't.
To be in God's will?
I hear what you're saying. I'm not hearing you. But
to be united with God's will.
Change. That's closer. But another.
To love God.
To what?
To love God.
Well, that is all. That's true. The only source of true happiness in this world is in doing God's will.
Oh, I'm sorry, Father.
Doing it.
Close but no cigar.
And the devil, he tries to make good people unhappy. He wants to keep them from doing God's will, as though doing God's will is a source of unhappiness. That's a lie. No, of course. Remember, so happiness all happiness is satisfaction of desire. That's the philosophical definition of happiness. The satisfaction of either desire or a desire or desires. Well, therefore, it all depends on what we desire. Now, the deepest source of happiness is the satisfaction of what desire? Is it?
To do God's will.
Please, will. Yes. But there are desires. In general, we can satisfy our own desires or we can satisfy what God's desires, what He wants for us, or we can be caught between our own two zeros and the will of God. And then that kind of a person, well, may be happy in the morning but sad at night or certain hours of the day. Now, most people are in conflict between satisfying their own desires, what they want, and satisfying, we don't usually use the expression, the desires of God, the will of God, what God wants for us. So there's only one thing I need to know in life. That's all. What does God want in my life? Nothing else. And then I'll be as happy as it's possible to be this side of heaven. Let's say the Lord's Prayer together until I tell you to stop. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Period. Now, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. That's what heaven is. Everybody is doing the will of God. Oh, there's a slight difference between the happiness on earth and the happiness in heaven. Just a slight difference. On earth, in doing God's will, we have to suffer. We have to carry the cross. But that's a contradiction. Don't be silly. Don't you dare say that again. There is no contradiction between happiness and suffering. Do you believe that? The cost of true happiness is the cross. And there's so many stupid people running away from the cross trying to be happy. And the cross, we all know what the cross is. The most fundamental definition of the cross is when two wheels cross. This is God and this is me. And God knows his geometry. You want to just be 50% or 78% angle, you know, degree. It would be 90 degrees sometimes. The very opposite of what we would want, he sends us. Then what do? We rejoice. I didn't used to teach this way 30 years ago. I do now. It's real. So, there were 85, 86. Victory over the enemy is greater when we win from him a man whom he holds more strongly and through whom he holds more people. The devil is most eager to seduce influential people because such persons can become tools of the evil spirit. There is more glory to God by converting those in authority than those who are under authority. Christ is more victorious over Satan when we succeed in converting influential persons to the true faith. All three are correct. What would you think?
I'm wrong all the time, Father.
Well, you're not. Well, nobody can be wrong. You can't be wrong here. It's just being more or less right. So what do you think?
I have C, Father.
C.
B, Father.
Christ is more victorious over Satan than we succeed in converting influential persons to the true faith. That looks good to me. All three could be correct. I think C looks good. 87. The enemy held my will, and of it he made a chain and bound me. The devil can enslave people. We can allow the devil to deprive us of our free will. We can become so inordinately attached to creatures that the devil seduces us from doing God's will.
See
again, you think? It can't be two. The devil cannot deprive us of our free will. The devil can enslave people. True, but then C explains A. So I think again C is, I think, the best answer. Habit had grown stronger against me by my own act, since I had come willingly where I did not now will to be. Repetition of a sinful act produces a sinful habit. Bad habits can be so strong that sins are committed even against the will of the sinner. We induce our own bad habits by our own sinful acts of will, even to the point of becoming helpless by ourselves to overcome a sinful habit. A. Repetition of a sinful act produces a sinful habit. I think A. Now C is a nice answer, but there's nothing about grace in the statement, you see, that you needed God's help. So C is saying more.
In C it says we're helpless by ourselves.
Well, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
See, I had come willing, where I did not, now will to be. You know, C is a better answer. However, in the light of the statement, you know, what does the statement say? At any rate, as you see yourselves, there are options here. I would like A, however, I think C is a good answer. 89. The law of sin is the fierce force of habit. The repetition of a sinful action produces a sinful habit. Sinful habits follow a strict law. They produce a humanly irresistible tendency to keep committing a habitual sin. Only God's grace, available through prayer, can break a sinful habit. Yeah? What do you think?
A.
A. You see, the other two are correct. Well, no, B is wrong. B is false. So, we never say irresistible tendency. And C is good, but it says more than the statement says. I think A is the best answer. Suddenly the man who was doing the reading was filled with a love of holiness and angry at himself with righteous shame. God's grace regularly uses the written word to draw people out of sin into the faithful service of Christ. B. Good Catholic reading is a powerful source of grace, especially for people who are well educated. C. Divine grace can work a miraculous conversion on a sinner who sympathetically reads a Catholic writer. In other words, the question is, what does the statement above mean? Not more than it means, but what does it mean? Carolyn?
A.
Did you say?
A.
A. Well, I'd have difficulty with the word regularly. God's grace regularly uses the written word to draw people out of sin into the faithful service of Christ. Because nothing is said about what kind of writing. I can tell you, God's grace does not regularly use the Detroit Free Press to draw people out of sin into the faithful service of Christ. As people told me, Father, you're being slick, you're being clever. No. What does the statement say? I think, what do you see? I think C is the best answer. And notice, he's a Catholic writer. Divine grace can work a miraculous conversion. Put good Catholic literature into people's hands and you can expect miracles.
Father, I was back when I read the Free Press, I was reading the Free Press, and a letter to the editor said, described that he went into a Coney Island downtown, a restaurant, and he saw a policeman, a big policeman, order his lunch. When it came, he bowed over and said grace.
The policeman.
Since I've read that,
The policeman said grace.
The policeman thanked God for the food, and so the Free Press, in God's
providence,
works.
Yes.
It could happen.
Yeah. But except Daniel. Daniel, but A does not say can. It says God's grace regularly, and then we won't worry. It says so. God's grace regularly uses the written word. It better be something, and even the Free Press can be. So when the Free Press carries such an article, that's a minor miracle already. Now the matching of columns. Baptize Augusta.
95
St. Ambrose. St. Augustine's, oh, not yet. Not St. yet. Augustine's natural son. Augustine's natural son. What is it? Adiodatus. That's the English pronunciation. 99. Received Ambrose into the church. Received Ambrose into the church.
91.
Please?
91.
Simplicianus. Is that correct? Okay. 94. Then is it the walls that make Christians? Question.
96.
90 what? 96. 6 did you
say? 96.
96.
That's 96.
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay. A law prohibiting Christians from teaching literature and rhetoric.
92.
Emperor Julian. The full name of Julian is Junius the Apostate. He had been a Catholic. He gave up his faith. He became one of the worst persecutors of the church. Julian the Apostate. Egyptian monk.
93.
93. St. Anthony. And notice the spelling. The spelling is always A-N-T, not T-H, for Anthony of Egypt. And who would remember? This would really be something. Who would remember who wrote The Life of St. Anthony of Egypt? It's one of the great biographies of the early church, St. Athanasius. St. Athanasius. Who knows how old Anthony was when he died? Well, my memory tells me 126 years old. And he was a very mortified man. Did nobody tell you that mortification, you know, cuts down on your lifespan? I don't have to tell you that overeating or indulgence in food shortens one's life. My heart's brother. One hundred. Alypius. That correct? Okay. Boy emperor whose Arian mother persecuted the Catholic Church. What'd you say?
94.
94? Valentinian. Okay. Remember, the Arians were those who did not believe in what? And the divinity of Christ. Before conversion, thought Christ was a phantasm. Somebody.
98.
Nebridius. Okay. And then, grant me chastity and continence, but not yet. Who said that? Who else? Okay. Now, any questions before we go on to St. Therese? Would you distribute these? There are two pages. Of course, the lesson on the little flower, the questions are based on her own life story. Now what I'd like to do, since we started a little later, if I can speak a little longer, is that all right? For the next time, if I may ask you, now I will not be here next Tuesday, I'm going to be in Canada, and say a prayer for the Catechist of the Archdiocese of Vancouver in British Columbia. Isn't that wonderful? I'll be giving them lectures, and listen, they want all the lectures to be on the Eucharist. And the Archbishop of Vancouver is behind it. Isn't that refreshing?
Yeah.
So, I'll be in Vancouver. I'm leaving on Friday. And I'll be there until late Thursday night. Now, I would be free, but it's not necessary, of course. I would be free on Friday. Saturday, I have to give a lecture in Chicago. But think about it. Friday, as the second Friday of this month, I will be in Detroit for one day. In the evening, I'll be teaching Mr. Monahan, his wife, and his entourage on the Bible. So the classes are from 6 to about 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the evening. The 11th, I think it is, of October. So either let me know now, or if not, then we'll meet 2 weeks from today. Otherwise, if you want to, let me know. What do you think, sister? Would Friday be out? Friday would be out. Okay. So then our next class, it'll be 2 weeks from today, which is what? 15th of October. I'll have to check. I think I am home, because and my reason for taking these lectures is, first of all, these are people who are studying their faith, and then whatever you give them, you encourage them, and especially in the Vancouver Archdiocese, you have thousands of children whom they are catechizing. So I should be home on the 15th. So then the 15th of October, whose feast is so, another Teresa. Is that correct?
Weekdays when you can be free for another.
Please?
So, Friday you can be free for another.
I can. Yeah, I like that. Friday I can be free. Friday, this Friday, I can be... Not this Friday. Next Friday... Oh, what am I saying? Friday of... I know. October the 11th. Because otherwise I would have to miss all next week. Yes. I can be free on the 11th of October. All right? Okay. I think then our class will be... Our next class will be on the Little Flower, and I will ask you then to, if you don't mind, cover the first 30 questions. The first 30 questions on the Little Flower. They are based, you notice, on the 5 chapters of the autobiography, which are described in the textbook. And I don't have the textbook in front of me. Anybody got a copy of, well, at any rate, it's the Treasury of Kathy Wisdom. Would you get it? Might be a good idea. Let me then talk for the rest of today's class on the spirituality of the Little Flower. As we know, Teresa of Lisieux was a Carmelite cloistered nun who died of tuberculosis. Who knows how old she was when she died? 24 years old. So she did not live a long life, but she did live a very fruitful life. Thank you. By the way, say a prayer because Doubleday, the publisher, is not the publisher that I used to deal with. They have withdrawn this book from print. And not because it's not selling, but because of the contents. And the book is militantly Catholic. At any rate, it's a matter, of course, of finding a publisher, but it's his work. But the hardest thing is getting the copyright back from Doubleday to allow me to publish on my own. Because, see, it's about a 12-page contract, all kinds of conditions. So keep it in your prayers. Books that I publish, and with Doubleday, the average length of their books, lifetime of book, is 8 months. Now, this book was published in 87. So it's 4 years in existence. The average life of a book for a Doubleday is 8 months. So this is, now this book is selling, but you have to really want to sell the contents of a book to keep it in print. Regarding the Little Flower, there are certain features of our spirituality which the two popes, the one who beatified her, Benedict XV, and the one who canonized her, Pius XI, bring out. If you really want to understand the spirituality of a saint, well, the church understands that person's spirituality, the best place to go is in the document issued or released by the Pope at the time of the person is either beatified or, in this case, also canonized. The distinctive spirituality of the Little Flower is what the Church calls the spiritual childhood. Spiritual childhood. In fact, the terminology, we may say, has been coined by the Church since the Little Flower's death. What does the Church mean by spiritual childhood? As you know from today's gospel, you know, there's a special gospel, do you know that? For today's Mass. It's the gospel when our Lord, remember, takes a child, and tells his disciples, "Lest you become like a little child, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven." Notice, none of us is born a spiritual child. We have to become children in spirit. Because when we are not only born, already when we're conceived, we already are human beings. Each of us is a human person from the moment of conception. Well, the body from conception, well, is already a human body. And provided the body is properly nourished and cared for, it will grow. However, and this is so important today, however, is it possible for the body to be nourished and cared for, and the soul not grow. Is that possible? This is awfully important. In other words, the spiritual childhood, which the little flower first lived in her own life and then became the model for others to imitate. Isn't that perfect? Oh, does the baby want to come in? Or?
There's the little children, Father. There's the little children.
Yeah. And bring the baby in. She's, is it a she or a he?
It sounds like a he. Yeah.
He probably must be. The expression growing in childhood seems to be a contradiction in terms. Who knows? And my day is made. Who knows? The English word for an apparent contradiction.
Paradox.
A what?
Paradox.
Paradox. How do you spell that?
That was two questions.
Next question. How do you spell paradox?
P-A-R-A-D-O-X.
P-A-R-A-D-O-X. Okay. Doxa, that something is being manifest, some truth is being taught, but para, it is being taught, but it seems to be a contradiction. What then does the church, and by now there is a library of the theology of spiritual childhood, what does the church mean by spiritual childhood? Mary, what do you think? Please?
For a person to become like a child.
Like a child, but notice, a child in body or a child in spirit?
A child in spirit.
Child in spirit. And a child in spirit is not as you mothers, you know. Here are some of the qualities of spiritual childhood. Docility. Our children naturally docile. Well, yeah. See, you're speaking from more experience than I. However, there is a built-in docility in a child, unless the child is spoiled. What does docility mean?
Quiet.
Please?
Quiet. Peaceful.
Yeah, that's part of it. Docere, to teach. In the Latin. Docilis, teachable. So docility is teachableness. Okay. Now, a child, naturally, as a child, is teachable. It better be teachable, otherwise we never learn anything. Another quality of a child, naturally speaking, is a child naturally dependent. Yes. Is a child naturally submissive, naturally. The child can, of course, and you mothers know how well you know that as a child grows naturally, the docility, the dependence, the simplicity, can that be spoiled? It sure can be. On the other hand, there's a difference between a child person who is spiritually a child, with that person's relationship. See, childhood, whether natural childhood or now we're talking about spiritual childhood, expresses a relationship. In other words, a child naturally is identified as a child by its natural and necessary dependence, say, on its parents. Talk about dependence. For 9 months, the mother carries a child in her womb. That's dependence. The child has to be nursed. I would ask, how long can a newborn baby survive without being fed? I thought maybe a couple of days. How often do you have to feed a baby? I don't even ask the father. He knows. Father, you have no idea how many times I've had to get up since we've had our baby. So, the relationship between a child, whether naturally or spiritually, is what identifies its childhood. And consequently, there are two kinds of relationship. Okay. Is any of that cost there? So childhood is a relationship. Now, the relationship can be between one's parents and the child. And all the qualities that we associate with childhood in its relationship to parents, then we elevate, in other words. And now, God and we. Am I making sense? In other words, there is a built-in, necessary relationship between what we call a child and its parents. It is first and most important. Total dependence. Except for the parents, there wouldn't be a child. And until the child is born, again, total dependence, as we now know from the crime of abortion. The very life of that child depends on the mother. Then when we are born, the dependence does not stop. Dependence, in so many ways, food, care. For example, does a child, when it's born, does a child have to be, well, held and caressed? Does something happen to a child that is not thus? Yes. it becomes permanently damaged. I may have told this story some years ago, community of nuns in Pennsylvania that run homes for retarded children. Well, this was in Elverson, Pennsylvania. And there, I was working on my Modern Catholic Dictionary. It was out of circulation, had quiet, and I could write, and nobody would disturb me. So I'd walk around, say Mass for the sisters, and one day, it was during the summer, I was walking outside, and there was a child, a girl about 9 years old, as I remember. And the sister introduced me to the child, and as soon as she introduced me to the child, the girl fell down on the floor. She dropped herself to the ground and began hitting her head against the pavement. She was an autistic child. You know what an autistic child is? What's an autistic child?
They live in their own world.
Totally in their own autos, in themselves, completely. It seems the parents did not want that child. So they brought the child into the world, and then I don't know when it started, but until the age of 4, that child was locked up in a room, given food to eat, and never even handled by the parents. Some neighbors found out, called in the police, and found out that child, at the age of 4, was again just banging his head against the wall. It needed to be caressed, to be touched, to be shown affection. 5 years later, the child was gradually coming out of it, but still living in its own world. So the dependence, you follow the logic. Everything we know naturally about the dependence of a child on its parents, faith tells us, should be elevated to our dependence on, reliance on, relationship to, attitude towards God. Okay? And this takes a lifetime to learn. Am I still clear? Because for the present purpose, God is the great parent. Parens, primissimus, the very first parent. And in this we've got to grow. In other words, to grow in our sense of reliance of, trust in the love of, obedience to. You follow the logic? What a child either has or needs to cultivate towards its parents, we both are to recognize and develop in our relationship to God. And that is why, and it's all over even the Old Testament, but especially the New. We are what? We are children of God. But notice, that's not a cheap word. Beyond that word, children of God, is locked up everything that we have to develop and cultivate and grow in our relationship to that God who loves us and on whom we totally depend, and takes a lifetime to learn it.
But how come that's not an inherent ability for us?
How come
we aren't born with it?
We're not born with what?
How come we aren't born with that inherent ability to be totally dependent on God?
We are born with the ability. We are. But it's a very, very darkened and weak ability because of sin. And I think I told you this story about my student at Western Michigan University, remember? Who was a prisoner of the, not a prisoner, the Nazis. Tell you about this? See, the Nazis wanted to produce a superior race. And so what they did, they got the most gifted men and the most gifted women they could find in Germany. And they mated them. So the children conceived by those parents would be the leaders, of mankind, superior race. So the German people would be in charge of everybody else on earth. They produced several hundred children like that. Well, that's just a background. While teaching for 5 years at the State University in Kalamazoo, Western Michigan, I always gave term papers at the end of a term, 10 pages they had to turn in on some subject. I gave them a variety of subjects on which they could write. One fellow turned in a paper. Ever tell you this? One fellow turned in a paper. I had, on an average, I had 2,000 students. So I'd have about 250 each semester students. Those students were just hungry. They had published a book called The Hungry Generation. Read the book. Didn't you get me a copy for Christmas? I didn't have a copy of my own book. She bought me a copy of The Hungry Generation. It's worth reading. So I went over the term papers, and this one paper I read, and I said to myself, this man copied from somebody, or somebody else wrote the paper. So I put a big F on the paper. See me in my office. So he came to my office. Big hulk. I said, sit down. Do you know why I gave you an F? I said, no, I thought I wrote a good paper. You wrote a good paper. You didn't write that paper. He said, Dr. Hardin, that's my alias. I wrote that paper. Look, I know people. You did not write that paper. I tell you, I'll be merciful. If you write another paper, do you write it? I'll give you a passing grade. But I wrote it. I wrote that paper. There was no way I'd either flunk him or believe him. So he said, all right. I know you don't believe me. Let me tell you a story about my life. On one condition, you never identify me. Never. Who I am. I know who he is. He said, I was conceived in this Nazi fertility farm. I don't know my parents, but they were handpicked by the government. And, from infancy we were brought up. We had everything. The rest of Germany could be starving. And towards the end of the war, it was starving. We always had enough food. The best of care. The one thing we were never taught was anything about God. Never. The word God never occurred. Never. Well, he said, our Nazi owners made a mistake. If we really are smart, as they thought we were, then maybe we'd find out there's a God without anybody ever telling us. By the age of 4, he said, I was praying. That's good to hear, isn't it? So back to your question. it can be done. But, in other words, we do have, there is a built-in capacity. Well, there are three things that militate against that capacity, besides, of course, original sin. The first is our parentage. Genetics. Please?
What happened to him? Did he really write the paper?
I gave the guy an A.
Oh, you did write.
I gave the guy an A. And I told him, now look. In fact, I found out later on, and even the conversation, because with so many students, I could, you know, could hardly talk to most of them, even privately. But his conversation was superbly intelligent. I asked him questions, and he knew the answers. So genetics, and that is why I tell people, and maybe, well, Daniel, you were there, and also, let's see, Laurie, were you there when the doctor, is that a woman doctor that comes to the classes on Wednesdays?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And she said, what about the child in the womb? Does it begin to learn? It sure does. It sure does. For 9 months, that baby is being educated by the mother. Because, or now we can start class all over again. So genetics. Secondly, the environment into which that child is born and in which it is reared. And thirdly, education. Anybody who knows any psychology knows the three most important influences in our lives are our origin, heredity, environment, and education. However, God's grace, and this is where I tell people that not only does the child begin to learn already in the womb of the mother, but the moment that baby is born, you start telling that baby about God. Mean. Sure. Now the first visual images will be sacred images. A picture of the Blessed Virgin. The cross. Every sense impression we ever have received influences our thinking to the end of our lives. The child cannot yet, obviously, at the age of 1 day, cannot reflect. But that child can think. Do you hear me? That child has a mind. And that mind is being fed images, impressions. That's why, with regarding that autistic child, the love that that child is shown by being hugged by the mother, cared for, that is love being taught to the mind of that child. That somebody cares. And in fact, if the atmosphere in the child in which the child is reared is not a loving atmosphere, it would never even know that God is a loving God. Because all our ideas, even about God, somehow depend on the knowledge we have from the world in which we live. And let me go, it's already five, let me go five more minutes. Is it okay? Till three. So that's the general principle of spiritual childhood. Am I clear? It is something that must be developed, and it takes a lifetime. And this is where unless a person grows in spiritual childhood and grows not only in physical, say, strength in the body, but the mind. The more educated the mind is, the more it needs to grow in spiritual childhood, because there are three words that are used for what we call there is the psyche, there is the bios, and there is the, these are three words that identify life in the New Testament Greek. This word is the Greek word for spirit. Spirit. And St. Paul distinguishes between having a bodily life and even having a mental life, and having the spiritual life. The spiritual life is the life of the soul in which the Holy Spirit, God Himself, dwells by His grace. So when we talk about spiritual childhood, it means that our soul, a child, every human being has a soul as long as it's alive. But not every soul has the Spirit of God dwelling in it. And consequently, how well I know, having taught for so many years in enough universities, to say it, the most dangerous people on earth are the educated people who don't have the faith. And among those, the most dangerous are those who don't have the grace of God. And the more educated they are, the more dangerous they are. And this is where our soul has to grow, and has to grow spiritually. It is not enough to have the mind developed, even the will. The soul must grow in the grace of God. And on our part, and this of course is why Christ both gave the example that we had in today's gospel and throughout. We are all naturally proud. We all naturally want to do our own will. The most precious possession we have on earth, the one that we hug the most, hold on to for dear life, is our own will. And we go in spiritual childhood when, and it takes a lifetime to do it. That's why God keeps some people on earth longer than others. I can now speak safely. They need more time to grow in spiritual childhood. As I was reminded, remember, by my novice master in the novitiate, called me in and he said, "You know what's wrong with you? You must have some minor faults. Everybody has. You are an intellectual bully. I'll give you 30 days to show some signs of humility. And I want to ask you if you're more humble. I'll ask you fellow novices, if they think Hardin has some slight improvement in humility, you stay. Otherwise, I've been working on my humility ever since." Believe me, I could write a book on spiritual childhood. It's not easy. Shall we close?
No.
Santa Maria, Mater Dei, ora pro nobis peccatoribus,